This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 33 proposals from across the country are being considered for a National Science Foundation initiative to shape the future of science. Three of those entries in the NSF's 2026 Idea Machine competition come from Western Michigan University. We're joined by three people involved in two of those entries. Todd Ellis is professor of geography and science education. Terry Goss-Kinsey is Western's vice president for research, as well as a professor of biological sciences. And Lori Wingate is director of research at the Evaluation Center at WMU. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
So explain how this got started at Western Michigan University to try and come up with these entries for the National Science Foundation initiative.
I'll start. I was fortunate to hear about the NSF Idea Machine at a conference I attended last summer in Montana, and I was really intrigued with the idea of getting the best and brightest ideas from Western Michigan out on a national format. I talked to President Montgomery. He was equally enthusiastic, and so we decided to really promote this at Western to try and really get people to share things that they thought could transform science and education in the next 8 to 10 years in this country.
And there was actually a preliminary competition right on campus, correct?
Correct. The idea that we had was to run a competition where anyone who sent their idea to NSF would also send it to my office. And from there, we actually did an internal competition and picked winners. Todd was one of our winners, as were two of our freshmen in the College of Engineering who won scholarships, money, and money to do research here at the university. And then we had our external winners that were chosen by NSF. Those are the three big ideas you heard about.
For me, the internal award involves $5,000 worth of a scholarship that I can offer to an undergraduate or graduate student to help me get my idea off the ground. I can't wait to go out and try to select somebody to help me pull my idea together this coming semester.
So let me ask, what does "why not me" mean?
So I happen to be someone who finds social media a really interesting platform for national dialogue. And so the idea of hashtag why not me was to take something where someone might say that in a negative way, why not me? There's a lot of reasons why people can be intimidated by a career in STEM. But if you turn that around and you say, why not me? You celebrate all of the reasons why you could be successful in a career in STEM. And so I'd like this idea of playing on recognizing that there are barriers, but finding the ways to really overcome and successfully create really rewarding careers for people. And that's why, with my colleague Lori Wingate, who's the expert on really evaluating programs and ideas, to think about how do we find successful people and mine that rich data about they answered that question, why not me, in the positive, and they've succeeded. And how can we learn from that and really grow those ideas?
And is that the way of tipping the balance here between that positive and negative answer to the question of why not me is finding people who did answer it in the positive, in the affirmative?
That's right. So I was really inspired by actually NPR's StoryCorps, which I think is just amazing. So all these wonderful, rich stories of real life. And I just thought, what if we tap that sort of format to actually gather a whole new kind of data about what drives people into STEM or keeps them out of STEM? So we're all, you know, in our research and evaluation now, we're very constrained to starting from what we already know to investigating a few variables that we think are important. But what if we just blew that wide open and listened to people's really the rich details of their lives and use the technology that's now emerging, so artificial intelligence technology, to mine that data to build something from the ground up for a much richer understanding that really helps to understand how it works in real life instead of trying to set up real controlled situations that may or may not reflect how things come about in the real world.
Is the idea to do it in the StoryCorps format of like an oral history, or is it some other way that you try to bring these stories out?
We thought of five questions that we thought would be extremely illuminating, just asking people what their job is and what they love about their job when they first knew they wanted to work in STEM. And if there was an event, a person, or experience that was really pivotal in helping them to realize that that's what they wanted to do. And importantly, if there was ever a time that they doubted they could be successful in STEM and how they overcame that barrier. So to collect these rich stories and then mine them for a real understanding of how people are drawn to and stay in STEM from all walks of life.
So beyond the ideas of fairness and equality, what are the reasons that we should want women, minorities, and maybe other underrepresented groups to find their way into STEM fields?
There's a major economic reason why STEM is so critically important to the competitiveness of the U.S. economy. They are some of the best jobs that we have out there, and we know that we have a shortage of people in areas like computer science, many forms of engineering, physics. If we don't tap the full potential of everyone in this country, and we know many children are fascinated by science, how do we keep them in there? We won't be able to fill the jobs that we have. The world is changing, and we really need a very rich, deep bench of people across STEM. I'd also add that what we know is a lot of people who study STEM also go into jobs that are outside of traditional STEM disciplines. It could be public policy. You can say education as a form of STEM. It really is what will give us a national and international advantage in terms of our economy.
Is the idea to use social media to try to find people with a story to tell?
So we actually, there's a number of ways we could find these people. So going to conferences, going to universities, going to businesses, so getting people from all walks of life, and having like a mobile pod the way StoryCorps does it, and going out to different places, also having an app where people can record and upload their own stories, and definitely tapping into the social media aspect is just a wonderful way to spread the word about that.
Being able to record on site quickly without maybe having to do a lot of preparation and soundproofing, that
right,
sort of thing.
Right. A little booth where people go and get those prompts and tell their stories, do it online on their phone, and just really have this immense, rich data set that we just don't have right now.
Todd Ellis, how would the teaching and learning incubator work?
Well, the incubator idea borrows from the tech incubator, which has been around since the 90s. The idea is that when somebody has an entrepreneurial idea, they go to one of these incubators and get not only the technical support they need, but access to resources they might not be able to afford, and the support to take their idea out and put it in the real world. A teaching and learning incubator is trying to take that same idea, letting teachers who normally don't have the time or the resources to be able to innovate something truly unique in their classroom, and afford them the chance to play, give them equipment to work with, figure out how they'd use it, and then support them as they go try it in their own classroom.
How do you address the costs of such a thing in order to get it off the ground?
Well, the costs are always an issue, and one of the things that I would say is that in order to make this sort of thing work, it has to be a complete sort of regional community effort. So what we're envisioning is that universities that have the expertise in some of the more expensive toys could be the research hub, if you will, and then the local school districts can actually spend a little money, hopefully just a little money, to buy in and make that part of their normal professional development program, which they're spending money on already with maybe not the right kind of practice that some of their teachers would need. And the hope is that we would be able to reach out then to businesses and community organizations to show them we have this robust framework. If you invest your money here, we're going to be able to make a huge bang for this and give teachers an opportunity to try things that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Forgive the question here of the layman who doesn't know a whole lot about science education, but I guess I'm wondering, could you do some of that at the community college level? Because I just kind of think about Michigan. We have state universities in some areas, but we have community colleges in a lot more places. So could you center it there and maybe not exactly replicate it, but come close?
Absolutely. In fact, during the initial discussions that we were having about this idea, we wanted to be able to bring the community colleges in when we actually propose a few of these for the first time. They have, as you said, they're closer. In a lot of ways, they do have some of the basic tools needed, in some cases, really advanced tools needed to be able to help reach teachers where they are. The idea, though, is to make sure that wherever we're centering these things, we're giving people access to the resources they might not be able to get otherwise, and helping them to form a cohesive community of practice so that it's not just professors or grad students telling teachers this is what you need to do. It's the teachers themselves who are brainstorming, coming up with the ideas, and then reaching out to one of the facilitators and saying, hey, you know, I'd really love to know how to do this programming for Make a Robot. Can you give us access to that and tell us a little bit about how it works? So we're giving them what they need just in time. I think you can do that at any community college. And I just see it as maybe easier to have one regional hub to kind of funnel the money in and out. But I don't have any problem having community college partners.
Something you emphasize in your proposal is involving teachers in the process. Do the teachers you talk to, because there's some of them in your video, do they feel like they're left out of planning and developing and coming up with ideas for the classroom?
Some of the teachers do feel like they're left out, largely because of time as the number one limiting factor. They have certain standards they need to meet now, and they need to know that what they're using is going to work and get the job done. So they use previously vetted ideas, and oftentimes that doesn't lead to hands-on activities. What I have also heard then from some of the teachers is that the other resource is being able to afford some of the equipment that some of their ideas might require. They can't ask their school boards or the principal to go out and buy them a lot of equipment just to try something to see if it will work. So we're trying to take the privilege out of this and make it so people can come in and play with the very equipment they would use, borrow it, and then they didn't have to lay out those expenses. And there's no risk of them having a failed lesson and missing out on being able to get the right standards met in their own classroom.
We obviously talk a lot about STEM in a variety of ways, importance of getting students involved, importance of getting students who previously might not have thought about it for various reasons, women, minorities, etc. Do we maybe miss in that the idea of actually teaching it and how important it is that it is taught well?
I think we absolutely do have a somewhat slanted view, I think, of what good science teaching is. Good science teaching has been shown over the years to be about letting students have an opportunity to do the science themselves and bring what they thought into the process and sort of break their own ideas down and build them up with what they're able to do right there themselves. And the teacher, ideally, is just putting the right sort of puzzles in front of them for them to be able to explore the right ideas for their grade level. What doesn't make for good science teaching sometimes is either having someone who is so behind in terms of having time to develop new activities that they're just following rote material. I understand how that happens, and they need a little bit more opportunity to try the new approaches. And on the other hand, it doesn't always work to bring in somebody who's been a scientist for 20 years and put them in a classroom and have them sink or swim with trying to figure out how to negotiate the management of 30 eighth graders, some of whom are less apt to attend to the task at hand than others.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Three entries from Western Michigan University are among 33 from across the nation that are part of the National Science Foundation's 2026 Idea Machine. I'm speaking with geography and science education professor Todd Ellis, the director of research at Western's Evaluation Center, Lori Wingate, and WMU vice president for research, Terry Goss Kinsey, who's also a professor of biological sciences. Can we say a word or two about the other entry, a reversibility future of life on Earth?
Yeah, I'm very excited about our colleague Belinda Strait's idea. we hear so much about changes that are occurring, whether they're natural catastrophes, the flooding that we're hearing about in the Midwest, and we have to think about these events as very catastrophic events, but things where there's the opportunity to reverse these effects. And I think the idea that she puts forward really from her unique perspective as an anthropologist thinks about how these events and the people can be resilient and can, you know, revise sort of outcomes of events that they're not a preconceived endpoint. And her videos is really a lot of fun to watch too.
So what happens next? Now that these videos are up, people have a chance to watch them. What's the process from here?
Well, right now, for the next several weeks, all of our videos and the 33 total entries are available on the Idea Machine website. You can watch their videos, and then down at the bottom is a comment box where they're asking for really 500 characters, I think, on what you think about that particular activity. Your comments are essentially your votes, and so they're going to be taking those comments and using them in addition to their own internal judging panel to decide who gets to go on to the next round.
So when will you know if you're going on to the next round?
The timeline shifts, like most things in life. Right now, I would imagine by the end of July, we'll know. I think it originally was supposed to be the end of June, but, you know, things happen. So we're just trying to stay patient and keep the word out.
Is there going to be one winner?
There should be 3 to 4.
Is a competition a more interesting way to try to get ideas generated than just saying, hey, let's meet for lunch, or, you know, let's try to, over the course of a semester or two, come up with some things related to science and science teaching?
I think the exciting thing about the NSF Idea Machine is that this competition was open to anyone 14 years of age or older who is a citizen or permanent resident of the United States. So frequently when we're talking, we may be talking to teachers, other faculty, maybe people in industry. But in this case, we actually are opening this up to people all across the country. Anyone could submit their ideas and anyone can comment. And I think that's really what's unique about NSF's idea is really about bringing in the public. And we are really excited to have as many people as possible look at our ideas and get this feedback, because we hope to take them forward no matter what happens with this competition. So the idea to get new ideas from all across the country, of course, we're hoping to get ideas from people who might participate in our projects, parents, very senior people who had early careers in STEM or specific experiences in teaching or have been subject to some of these environmental catastrophes, and how they can contribute to our ideas is really unique about this competition.
Terry should get a lot of credit for what she did for bringing Western's attention to this opportunity. So Western Michigan University has 3 of the finalists, which is incredible. It's just incredible. And I just don't think that would have happened without her initiative and giving people the idea that, yeah, you might have a really great idea. You could have a winning idea. And I just think it's amazing that Western is so well represented. And I don't think that would have happened without her leadership.
I agree.
The only university in the state which has any finalists at all.
Go Broncos. I would also add just one idea with all of this is a competition that's open to everybody gets us out of the possibility of getting into a thinking groove or a rut. You know, we tend to put out specific questions that we want people to propose answers to and then send the money to them to try to research it. This is every idea's fair game, and it can come from anyone in any walk of life. And that's where the really good ideas have always historically come. And I think that's what we're starting to get with this as well.
Todd Ellis is professor of geography and science education at Western Michigan University. Terry Goss-Kinsey is Western's vice president for research, as well as a professor of biological sciences. Lori Wingate is director of research at the Evaluation Center at WMU. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Links with more information about Western Michigan University's entries in the National Science Foundation's 2026 Idea Machine competition can be found at wmuk.org. You can subscribe to WMUK's West Southwest podcast through Apple Podcasts and by searching for podcasts in Google Music. It can also be found on our website, WMUK.org, and the WMUK app. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.